All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And it is with great pleasure that I introduce the speaker that we have tonight. Jen is such an important person in my life today. She was my first sponsor, and she's the first person that ever took me through the steps, obviously. She remains a very close friend today. She works an awesome program. She's so committed to Alcoholics Anonymous and does service wherever she can and is just an all-around just great person. And I am so excited to hear her story tonight. So y'all welcome Jen. Hey, y'all. I'm Jenny. I'm an alcoholic.
There are a lot of you guys.
Thank you, Jackie, for inviting me to speak tonight, Tim and other Tim. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that it's what I've been put here to do, and that it's my part of my job today is to carry this message the way that it has been carried to me. My sobriety date is March 30th, 2012. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor other women. And I love that you started with that reading, because that's exactly what I was going to start with. So thanks for taking care of that for me. My story is just that. It's my story, and I only know one way to tell it. I don't want to spend too long in the drunkalogue, because you guys were out there too, and you know what we did, and I'm sure we did some of the same stuff. One thing that was encouraged of me early on was to listen for the similarities rather than the differences. We may or may not have done the same things, but regardless of our stories, we all have felt the same way, and we all used alcohol and all those other substances to fill that hole inside us. And here we go. I was born and raised in an alcoholic home. I was born to an alcoholic mother and a father who is affected by this disease also. I'm from Palm Beach, Florida, and I say that only... Or not only, but I say that because if it's one thing I've learned in this program, it's that it doesn't matter our background. It doesn't matter whether I grew up poor or whether I had a lot of money. It didn't stop me from being alcoholic. Growing up, there were a lot of parties. Everybody was always drinking. It didn't really matter what the situation was. Alcohol was always involved. I went to private schools, conservatories, and really never, aside from one brief experience, really never had public school experience. And that, really all that means now is that we had more money to spend on alcohol. I did go to public school really briefly, my sixth grade year, and this is really kind of where everything got started. It was midway through that school year. I was about 11 years old, and standing outside before school, I had made a friend from what I called regular school, public school, and this friend and I and a few of our neighbors were standing outside in front of school. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning before school starts. Another older boy walked up and shot my friend dead. And that night was the first night that I got drunk. I was 11 years old, and my best friend and I got drunk on the roof of my parents' house. And after that, I can't really say I became a regular drinker, but I drank as regularly as an 11-year-old could. Mostly on weekends, mostly at parties. We were always allowed to have a drink or two.
okay, a drink, and I made it two or three or four at parties on the weekends. And what I learned is that, you know, at those parties, my parents really weren't watching me. And I was old enough at this point to where I was supposed to be watching my brother, who's about 5 years younger. And, well, he may have been young, but he is alcoholic. So, you know, there wasn't any adult supervision necessarily. My disease came out in other ways, too, especially when I was young and I couldn't necessarily get all the alcohol that I needed. I was an overachiever, to put it lightly. I was the kid that had to do everything, had to be in everything, had to be good at everything, or I didn't do it. I used that as my way to try to earn love, try to buy your approval, your love, your affection, however I could. So early on for me, I've been playing violin since I was four. I've played professionally. I was a swimmer. I was captain of the varsity swim and dive team my ninth grade year. I ran cross country. I ran track. I was a lifeguard. I taught swimming. I did musical theater. I played flute. I was Key Club, National Honor Society. You name it, I was in it, and I was probably president of it. Because for a long time, I ruled the world. I don't do that anymore. You're welcome. So, for the most part. So whatever I did, I really thought that eventually I would get the right combination of activities and I would get it just right, and then my parents would love me. Then you guys would like me. Then I would be okay. Obviously, I never found that combination. Nothing ever worked for me. Going into high school, I went to kind of a prestigious high school geared towards the performing arts. And that was really an environment, think of dancers and actors and musicians, that was really an environment where alcohol and outside issues were really accepted. They weren't necessarily talked about, but they were accepted. Everybody did it, so it was okay. In high school, I became pretty immediately a regular drinker. I was drunk from pretty much Friday night through Monday morning or so, and Friday night became Thursday night, and Monday became Tuesday, and before you knew it, I was drunk all the time at 14. And still performing relatively well. There were a lot of weekend trips, a lot of travel. I wasn't ever at home. I wasn't ever at home for a lot of reasons. Part of it was that my younger brother was kind of beginning, his disease was beginning to progress, and he got all the attention. So it was easier for me to disappear and try to get attention other places. My mother's disease also continued to progress. And my father was abusive, and to this day would be if I would get close enough. So I did whatever I could to stay away and to stay out, and found other places where I could get the attention that I felt I needed and wanted. Also in high school is where my problem with outside issues started, and that continued to progress throughout the rest of the duration of my drinking and using. Part of my story is that I'm a former professional car wrecker. I totaled cars kind of on a like bi-monthly basis for a while there. And I'm going to tell this part of my story only because it becomes relevant later in my part where I get sober. So my very first car, cute little red Miata, lived on a little island. At the end of the island, the road turns. And one night we were drag racing, and I kind of missed the part where the road turned and drove my car into the ocean. So that's, you know, my claim to fame is that my car is still in the ocean somewhere. And this is my alcoholic thinking, is I drove a car into the ocean, and I swam to shore and went home and went to bed. I remember bits and pieces of that night, but in my head, there was nothing wrong with that. There was no cause to concern. It was what I did. And I've wrecked many cars since then. And I'm not proud of it, but, you know, it's what I did.
Professionally.
Exactly. Exactly. If you could be professional, I would have been. Got to be good at something. So, you know, life really kind of rocked on. High school is pretty much a blur. I know that I spent most of it drunk. I got good grades. I'm not sure how, because I didn't go to class. And that was my MO, is I was pretty much absent. I was at all of the parties, all of the events, all of the performances, meets, games, whatever. But I was pretty much absent in life. High school graduation happened. I had chosen where I was going to go to school. I was going to go to a prestigious music school in New York. And a couple weeks after I turned 18 right after I finished high school, and a couple weeks after I turned 18, I went out with this guy. I had this job, and it was cool because I was really good at my job, and I like things that I'm really good at. And I had met this guy who was 23, so the older guy. And, you know, guys are also part of my disease, something else that I used and abused. And I met this guy who I thought was really cool, and I had known him for a while, so I went out on a date with him. And that night, I was raped. I was held hostage by this man for a couple days while he continually abused me and tried to murder me. And that was where, if there was a turning point in my disease, that would be it. After that, until I walked into this room, I don't know that there were maybe more than a couple days at a time where I drew a sober breath. That was my fault in my mind. I had no tools. I had no way to process that. And as long as I was drinking and as long as I was using, all the therapy in the world couldn't help me through that. From that incident, I tell that because it's a turning point in my disease, and also because I've learned today that it's an experience that has happened to me that I've been able to heal and recover from, that I can now use to help others, because I know I'm not the only one who's been through that. And it's something I am able to be grateful for today. From that experience, I had a little girl. I had a daughter, very premature. I can say that I drank sporadically throughout my pregnancy, but I used something in some way, shape, or form every day that I was pregnant. I'm not proud of it, but it is part of my disease, and it's part of how strong and how powerful this disease is, that even though I didn't want to and I knew that it would or may hurt this child, I did it anyway because I couldn't stop. It didn't matter what the substance was. I couldn't stop. And that little girl was born a couple months premature and lived 10 times longer than I was told I would have with her. And I'm grateful. She lived about 7 months, and I'm grateful for every day that I had with her. During this time, I had made that decision to go to that music school in New York. And once I found out I was pregnant, I knew that I couldn't do that because that wasn't going to look good. And what were you going to think of me if I was pregnant at 18? So knowing that the only thing that mattered is what you thought of me, I knew that that wasn't the decision for me. My backup school was a school in North Carolina that I also knew I would be judged at. I needed to go someplace where nobody knew me. So I chose a smaller school in Florida, kind of one of the lesser known ones where I could fly under the radar and where nobody would know me, and it would be okay that I was pregnant because I wasn't that little girl from Palm Beach who used to do this and that and this and that. I was just another bozo on the bus. So I went to that school, and during this time, I'm still pregnant, y'all, and I'm rushing sororities, and I'm trying to basically pretend like my life is okay. And on the outside, I look okay. A little pregnant, but okay. On the inside, I was falling apart. I didn't know who I was. I hadn't dealt with the event that caused the pregnancy months before. I I had absolutely nothing, and I was drowning. So I met this guy, because guys make everything better. I met this man who, you know, he was the one. You guys have found the one before. I found the one. And he was really successful. He had was finishing school early, going to med school. He was going to be a neurosurgeon. He had never had a drink or a drug in his life. Had never done some other things, too. And I was like, wow, you look good. Come home with me. And that's pretty much how it went. And that man also helps raise my daughter. He, great guy. Absolutely great guy. Turns out he has the allergy, too. Go figure. And I'll get to him a little more later. But our disease continued to progress together, and we kind of got on this roller coaster together and buckled in together, and we were off to the races for a couple years. And I remember, it's kind of funny because it's the things you don't really think of until you get sober. You know, I had always thought, oh, I know exactly where I was when I went to my first meeting, and I know who I was with and how I got there. And I got to thinking about it, and I'm like, man, back in college, I used to, like, drop people off at AA. I was like, listen, you need help. Come with me. I know where to take you for help. So I had been to a couple meetings, maybe two or three meetings during my college career. But I don't ever remember hearing you guys talk. I don't ever remember what you talked about. I don't even know really necessarily where I went. But somehow I knew that there was a solution here. I didn't know it was one I was ever going to need because I was okay. I had it put together. But I knew that all my other friends who had problems, this is where I brought them. And, you know, for college, life rocked on. I, for the most part, had, thanks to my parents, had the resources that I needed to get everything that I needed to survive. The alcohol, the outside substances, whatever I needed. There was a point in time towards the end of college where my parents, I didn't graduate quite when I should have. I was supposed to graduate early, and I actually ended up graduating on time, which is no big deal in a normal family, but in my family it was the end of the world because I was supposed to be better than everyone else, and it was disappointing that I didn't graduate early. And my parents kind of realized what I was doing. They knew they were giving me a whole lot of money, and they knew that rent couldn't possibly be as much as I said it was, unless I was renting, you know, the entire apartment building. So they kind of put two and two together, and I got shut off for a little while and had to make some decisions about how to get what I needed. And I made some decisions I'm not proud of. I made the decision to use and abuse my body and to do that in order to get what I needed. And I think you guys know where I'm going with that, so I'm going to leave it there. But I know that that was also another stage in my disease, another stage of that, another level of desperation where I didn't realize it at the time, but I knew that there were substances, that there was alcohol, there were things out there I needed. At this point, it wasn't that I wanted it. I needed it. And the only question was, how was I going to get there? How was I going to need that? How was I going to get what I needed? College kind of comes to a close, and at this point, I'm still with Mr. Wonderful, you know, Mr. Perfect. And Mr. Perfect has proposed. And I said yes because, you know, he was perfect, and we were still locked into that roller coaster and had taken each other hostage. And, you know, it was great. We were going to be this happy family. I graduated college, had the realization he had like 5 more years of his residency or something, and I was like, holy crap. I don't want to be here. I love you, but I don't want to be here. So I pulled a geographic because it worked for me. You know, I went from Palm Beach to Tampa, and it worked pretty well. I found Mr. Wonderful. So I thought, hey, you know, I'll pull another geographic, and I'll go to Atlanta. I don't know why I came here, you guys. I didn't know anyone here. I literally packed the car in the middle of the night, and me and the dog drove to Atlanta. And I ran away. It was about a month before our wedding, and I just ran. Little runaway bride, but you know. And I really, you know, I had that thought. It was going to be okay here. I didn't know anybody. How can I possibly get in trouble or do anything bad if I don't know anybody? It's really easy because there's a lot of y'all in Atlanta. There's a lot of you guys. I'm pretty sure I had like 30 new best friends after one night at happy hour. So my geographic solved nothing. And in fact, maybe made my disease worse because I had nobody to answer to. I could go out and be out partying for days or weeks at a time and didn't have to be accountable to anybody. I had left my fiance. I had left my family. My parents have been up here once in the 7 years I've lived here, so I pretty much wasn't worried they were going to show up. And my disease went from bad to worse. I don't remember several of the first years that I lived here. I know that the first 2 years that I lived here, I taught school, which means that I taught your kids drunk. And that's an amends that's been difficult to make. Because teaching was a passion, and it was something that I was good at, and it was something that I did enjoy. But I know that my disease prevented me from doing it the way that it should have been done. And in turn, I, you know, put children in harm's way. During this span of time, I met a few more Mr. Awesomes and Mr. Wonderfuls and loves of my life. And my pattern is that, you know, I want to get closer, come a little closer. Oh, you're too close, go away now. And that's happened more times than I can count. As soon as you can see who I really am, then you're not going to like me anymore and you need to go away. My pattern with whatever it is I've been doing is that I'm afraid of you seeing me, the real me, not the me on the outside, you know, not the performer, but I'm afraid of you seeing the real Jenny. And, you know, because of that, I've never let anybody get close before sobriety. Friends, lovers, whoever. So teaching didn't work out, obviously, because there wasn't enough time to drink. They don't let you out of that little classroom. You have 40 kids, and you're basically held hostage. Oh, and I taught 7th grade. So that was not really a great career choice on my part, especially drinking. It was trying, and that's all I'll say about that. So I moved on, and in my next career, or job, whatever, things kind of rocked on. My drinking got worse. My using got worse. I'm also in recovery from anorexia, and that also really helped the progression, speed the progression of my alcoholism. Because when you don't eat for days or weeks or whatever, you feel the alcohol and all the everything else a lot more. So at this point, this is about 2.5 years ago, and my disease, I'm also on the road a lot for work. My disease has me to the point where people don't think there's something wrong, but I weigh about 80 pounds at this point, and I don't have a place to live. You know, when I got sober, I said to my friends, hey, you know, I only lived in my car for like a couple weeks. It was like maybe a month. Okay, we can call it 2 months. It was recently that I was cleaning out a storage unit where we found some mystery stuff of mine. My friends were like, hey, you know you lived in your car for like a year, right? And, you know, guys, I had no idea. I have no memory. I mean, I really honestly thought I lived in my car and was homeless about a month. It was about a year. That's where my disease had brought me. And, you know, I learned that, yes, it is possible to grow up in Palm Beach, and it's possible to be that little girl who had everything and end up homeless. It's possible this disease did that. I made those decisions that got me in that situation. So, you know, it was obvious to a lot of people that I was doing something and there was something wrong. And I worked with this guy, this man, who, you know, we kind of like shared this office, and, you know, he was older than me, and he was nice and all, but I didn't really know what his deal was. He was like always really happy and positive, and there was obviously something wrong with him. And, you know, one day that guy said to me, "Hey, are you a friend of Bill?" And I'm like, "Who's Bill?" I have no idea. I'm like, "Which one?" "Oh, I don't know what he looks like." "What do you got?" I mean, guy's over my head. I had no reference point, no idea. And he was like, "Okay." And he kind of let it ride. I'm still clueless. I think he's talking about somebody I met at a bar. I have no idea. No clue. So a couple weeks later, this is, March of 2012. This was my last, my last big hurrah. I just didn't know it at the time. I went out on a Thursday night. During this time, I also, I was a fitness competitor, an NPC bikini competitor. So I spent a lot of time out in clubs, promoting with a lot of groups. You know, again, just being the pretty girl. As long as everything looks okay on the outside, then nobody else would know any different. And I went out on a Thursday night with some people I competed with. I remember that. I don't really remember anything else, except I know that we went out somewhere downtown, and I came out of a blackout on Sunday in Midtown on Peachtree and 12th, and just came out of this blackout and had no idea where I was, how I had gotten there. I was not wearing the clothes that I went out in on Thursday night, nor were the clothes that I was wearing my own. I didn't have car keys. I didn't have a purse. By some miracle of God, I had my cell phone in the back pocket of whoever's jeans I was wearing, and that cell phone still had a charge. And in my other pocket, I had a valet ticket, and I found where my car was. But while I was hiking to go get my car, I'm thinking, who do I call? You guys know how it is to go out and black out for a couple days. You don't know who you pissed off, who you slept with, who you did whatever with, who you made mad, who hates you now. And at this point, I had no one. I hadn't spoken to my family in probably a couple months. I hadn't seen them in over a year because of a little incident a few Christmases before that. I was permanently uninvited to my family's home. And I thought, you know, who the heck am I going to call? So this guy, this, you know, kind of old work guy that I didn't, you know, kind of didn't like, super happy guy, something told me to call him. So I called him. He helped me that day. And a couple days later, he said, "Hey, you know, so how about a meeting?" I had no idea. I'm like, "What kind of meeting? Where are we going? What bar?" No idea. Guys, I'm still clueless. And that man, you know, this is how God works in my life. That man shared with me that he had 22 years sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys were there when I didn't know you were there, and you guys saved my life. My first meeting was a Friday night beginners meeting over at Skyland. And I only remember, you know, think back with me, guys. I only remember one thing from that night, is that the man who stood up and shared drove his car into the ocean. I heard that and I thought, oh, shit. Again, I'm not unique. My terminal uniqueness was crushed. You know, that was, I'm blessed. That's my one and only white chip, and I've been sober since. And I'm grateful. And I know that it's only by the grace of God that it only took one try for me to get here. Because there's no reason why I shouldn't be dead, other than God. I came into this thing quickly. I got a sponsor quick. I worked the steps quick. That's what I was taught. I was in the book from just about day one. And, you know, I was taught that our solution is in the book. It's in this first 164 pages, and that's how we get and stay sober. Meetings are important. Fellowship is important. But the solution is in the steps, because the steps lead me to God. And that's what I did early on. I was taught that we sponsor others. And I've been, Jackie, I think, was my first or second sponsee? Second. All right. Was my second sponsee, and, you know, it's women like Jackie who helped keep me sober. We walked essentially through our first year of sobriety together, and I am forever grateful for that. And I know that I've made lifelong friendships and lifelong relationships in this program and in these rooms. Life has happened in sobriety. You guys told me that life would get better. You didn't, or that I'd have a solution for living. But you didn't tell me that life would stop happening. And, okay, time. And life has happened a lot in sobriety. There's been several family deaths. I think I lost 5 or 6 family members my first year sober. There was good 5 or 6 at least the second year. And I've learned that I can stay sober through that. About a year ago, I lost the nanny who raised me, basically who was the love of my life, shielded me and saved me from a lot of the alcoholism and a lot of the abuse that happened in my home. And really, I sometimes believe that she was the only person who really loved me as a child. I lost her to breast cancer about a year ago. And a couple months ago, Mr. Awesome, you know, think back from college, he got sober a couple months before me. I didn't know it until he called me to make an amends one day. And I was, you know, I had about a week and a half of sobriety. And I'm like, crap, that's in that book somewhere. Wait, hold on. Hang on. I know what you're doing. And I remember getting my book and, like, flipping through his book. And I'm like, oh, man, wait, are you sober? And he had a few months longer than me. Unfortunately, didn't do some of the inner workings that's required to stay here. And relapsed late last fall and died of this disease just after Christmas. Again, if book knowledge could buy sobriety, he'd have it. He was a neurosurgeon, engaged to a beautiful woman with a young son, just about 2 years old. If money could buy happiness and sobriety, if knowledge could buy, an IQ could buy sobriety, there'd be a lot more people in this room tonight. And, you know, I've also... I want to kind of get my parents, my mother is still active in this disease today. And I wish, as much as I wish that she would find sobriety, I know that it's not the path for everyone. And I know that today I can give her the dignity or have the dignity to let her make her own decisions, even though it's not always easy. And recently I got the opportunity to make some medical decisions for my mother, who is in a not-so-great situation. And a quick kind of God story for me is I've been communicating with this doctor of hers. And, you know, we're talking on the phone because she's down in Palm Beach. And, you know, I can't really talk to mom because she's, like, totally gone and out of it. And, you know, this doctor's voice sounds familiar. And meanwhile, guys, AA is taking care of my mom. AA and Al-Anon, those fellowships are taking care of my parents in Palm Beach because I can't be there. I made some calls and you guys showed up. It doesn't matter where, it doesn't matter when, we're everywhere. So I'm talking to this doctor and he kind of sounds familiar. And I finally said, hey, you know, this is weird, but do I know you? I kind of figured small little island, small town. And this man shared with me that 10... almost 11 years ago, he was the ER attending who pronounced me dead after my rape. AA was there. I wasn't ready for you, but AA was there. You guys have shown up in my life when I didn't know you were there, when I wasn't ready for you. We have family friends who have 30, 35 years of sobriety. People who have basically raised me. You know, so you've been there all along, and you waited patiently until I was ready. You know, another thing in sobriety is that I've had difficulty staying employed. Funny that when I was out there, I held the same job for years. I get sober, and about 6 months is all I can take. And, you know, guys, that is... I had heard stories about people who kept losing jobs, and I was like, what is wrong with you guys? And, you know, now I'm unemployed again. This makes the second time in the 2 years that I've been sober. but I don't have to drink. That doesn't have to be my answer today. Does it suck? Absolutely. Am I feeling feelings about it? Yeah, I am. But, you know, today I have a track record. I know that last time I was unemployed that, you know, I did tons of service for you guys. I went to more meetings than I ever cared to talk about. And I was able to focus on my primary purpose, which is carrying the message. And I did the footwork and a job appeared. And I know that, and I don't want to say this because my sponsor is right here, but I know that if I just keep doing the footwork, and I know if I keep sponsoring y'all and doing this and going to meetings and doing the footwork, that a job will appear. It may not look the way I want it to look. It may not feel the way I want it to feel. It may not be the job that I've conjured up in my head, but I know that something will appear as long as I do that, as long as I take the steps and do the right actions. And, you know, my life, I can always find something to complain about. I'm an alcoholic. That's what we do. You know, I can look at the negative if I choose. But I want to say most of the time, a lot of the time, I can choose to look at the positive. You know, alcoholism took a lot of things from me. It's taken a lot from my family, but it's also given me all of the gifts that I have today. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for you guys and for the miracles that have been performed in my life. And my life today isn't what I wanted it to be. It isn't what I thought it would be. It isn't what I thought it should be, look like, feel like, whatever. And I'm not where I thought I, you know, I'm not at where I thought I should be. But my life is beyond my wildest dreams. You know, when I got here, you know, when I was walking up Peachtree in Midtown, I didn't have a single person in the world to call besides this random guy who, you know, just happened to turn out to be sober. Today, I have probably have hundreds of people I could call, and there's quite a few of them in this room. And that's what this program has given me. You know, I may not have the relationship from my family, with my family of origin that I wanted or that I thought I should have, but I have family in these rooms. I have people I can call any time of day or night. You know, I don't have the husband, I don't have the children, but I have plenty of people who share their wonderful children with me. And I'm grateful for that, that I'm someone today, that I have dignity today, and that I have respect for myself, and in turn I'm respected, and that I can be trusted, because I couldn't be trusted before, and most of you guys were probably in the same boat. I want to close with the last paragraph on 451 in the fourth edition of the story He Lived Only to Drink, because this for me really describes a lot of what's happened for me in this program. It says, the rewards of sobriety are bountiful and as progressive as the disease they counteract. Certainly among these rewards for me are the release from the prison of uniqueness and the realization that participation in the AA way of life is a blessing and a privilege beyond estimate. A blessing to live a life free from pain and degradation of drinking and filled with joy of useful sober living, and a privilege to grow in sobriety one day at a time and bring the message of hope as it was brought to me. Thank you.
Wow, thank you so much, Jen. That was great. Thank you.
First I slip, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window. For a heart it beats for me, takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something that sets me free. Promises are real. Take me where the promises are real.